Thank you. So this evening we will endeavor to get through the end of the book of Nehemiah, chapters 11 through 13. And chapter 11 through 13 have a lot of lists of names and people and places and so forth, and different classifications of folks and so forth. So I hope that reading wasn't too difficult, but there's a lot of good applications in there. So once again, who, what, where, when, and how? Who? Jews in Jerusalem. Where? Temple, walls, those sort of things. When? Toward the end of Nehemiah's time there in the in Jerusalem before he goes back to Persia for a while. And then why? God's plan. We're trying to put things together based upon God's plan to restore his people to the land and to bring his son, the Messiah, through that instrumentality. So let's go back to chapter 10 very quickly and look in verse 29. So in 29 down through 39, they make an oath to do certain things. What do they make an oath to do?
To not intermarry.
Okay, not intermarry, yep. Okay. But in big, broad terms, what do they make an oath to do?
Yeah.
Right, they will follow God's law as delivered by Moses. Yep, okay. So more narrow, you said not intermarry. What else?
Observe all the commandments of the Lord.
Okay, so observe all the commandments that Moses gave him. Yep.
Feed the Levites.
Yeah, that's right. Support the temple. Feed the Levites. What else?
Not buy and sell on the Sabbath.
Okay, not buy and sell on the Sabbath. Neither buy nor sell or do any kind of commerce or any kind of work on the Sabbath. They made an oath to do that. Okay, what else? Specifically things down like 34 and 35.
Yearly, they would give a third.
Okay. So they would give the shekel, a third of the shekel for the support of the temple. And what else would they give to the temple or to the Levites?
First fruits.
First fruits, yep. First of what?
Everything.
First of the dough, first of their crops, and so forth. Also, first one of our sons and of our cattle and so forth. So what else do they say they're going to do specifically in verse 34?
There's a wood offering. Is okay. Part of it?
Right. They're supposed to bring wood.
Yeah.
And what is that used for?
I found that odd, but it's used to burn off and burn off.
It's the kindle offerings, right? And so the Levites... The thing with the Levites was they didn't have a specific territory necessarily or land to bring wood from. Now, some of them actually, as we found out because of the misdeeds of the people, actually had to go back to different places, but they didn't have necessarily a land. So things like cattle and sheep and oil and wine and the wood would have to be brought to them because they didn't have their own stuff. So, preview of the end of the last few chapters, which one of those things do they actually do? All the above? None of the above, of course. Not even close.
Not even close.
So, I think the application for us is that we need to be very careful what we vow to the Lord. And be very careful what we say, I will never such and such. Or I would never such and such. Because you don't know. I mean, you know, James tells us, you know, don't say I'm going to go to a city and make so much money and be there for so long, because you don't know. But also, we see these people making this oath before God, and then in different parts, different ones of them breaking it all. So we need to be very careful about those sort of things. And, you know, when you say, I'm going to keep all the laws of God, you need to be very careful about promising that, because you're opening yourself up to ridicule and to second-guessing and those sort of things. So we ought to be very careful about that. Now, we need to do that, as far as we know of God's law, but we need to be very careful about making those kind of promises. So,
Great. How much time passes from chapter 10 to 13?
10 to 13? I know that Nehemiah was the governor for 12 years, so this is kind of the tail end of those 12 years. And then I would imagine it's probably between 3 or 4 years, maybe not quite that long. And then he goes back to Persia
and then he comes back to fix some of the problems in there. So I'm not really sure exactly what the time he is, but I think it's kind of close to the end of that 12 years where he was the governor.
Yes, but just for a reference to time of getting things set in order,
yeah,
and then turning it over to the people to kind of do it on their own.
Right.
How short of a time it really feels like that it just kind of gets neglected.
Right, absolutely. And we don't know how long he's going back to Persia. He said for a time. Could have been 2 years, could have been 4 years, could have been 10 years, I don't know. But as you say, things, as the second law of thermodynamics says, things went to disorder pretty quickly.
It's like, you know, I'm sorry.
Oh, go ahead, Jason, finish up.
So they, I mean, they kind of had a training manual, think about it from like a training and even in the workplace, like set processes in place, and then when there's a failure or breakdown, it's usually because the person just didn't see the value in the process that was put in place there. Mm-hmm. And I think it's the heart of the people. Not, they see the value in not being punished, like do what it takes to not get punished, but not see the value in what it takes to honor God properly. Mm-hmm. And it's just kind of, it's a difference in mentality of, to me,
mm-hmm,
I'm going to do this to not get punished, or I'm going to do this because I really want to honor the Lord and follow right. the statutes and commandments.
Yes, when that relates back to when I was a young man, I was scared to death of my father, absolutely petrified of my father, because he was a big man, he was a great sports guy, and I was scared to death of him. And I obeyed him because I was afraid of him. But as he got older, I obeyed him because I respected him, and I loved him, and wanted to please him. That's what we have to do with God. I mean, the fear of going into eternal punishment has to drive us to God. But love is the only thing that really helps us to remain.
Nehemiah also had the might to have it too. He had the authority to dole out punishment.
Right. Then, so did Ezra.
You know, when Papa's away,
mm-hmm,
the kids would play.
Yes. Absolutely. Yes. Good points. Thank you.
It's interesting that they make an oath, but they didn't.
They didn't follow through. They didn't honor what they said.
Didn't honor what, yeah, I think you remember that. The scripture that says in the gospel that do not all inherit because it's the throne of God.
Mm-hmm.
Do not all for Jerusalem because it's the city of the king.
True. Let your yes be yes, your no be no.
Yeah. So what I see is that, and what happened to Peter, that, oh Lord, I give my life to you, and for us to walk in the law of the Lord is very challenging,
mm-hmm,
because we need to honor our word to the Lord,
mm-hmm,
to serve others and
absolutely
be far from the world, pure and far from the world, and it's very challenging.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, one person described being baptized as signing a contract at the bottom, but the entire page is blank, and you allow Jesus to fill it in. Because of your trust of Him, and say, "Whatever, Lord, whatever You want me to do, I'm willing to do it." So I think that's a great thought that you had to kind of concentrate on our yes being yes and our no being no, and understanding when we sign on to being a follower of Christ. Christ said, "Count the cost. Have you really thought about what this means?" So that's very important. Okay, anything else? Those are great comments. I really appreciate that. Good discussion.
So in verse 38, chapter 9, verse 38, it says that they sealed the document with the names of princes, Levites, and priests.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you read at the beginning of chapter 10, the list of all the names, I don't know if I'm missing it. I don't see Eliashib in the list, and they're supposed to be the high priest, correct? So
yes.
I'm sensing there was sort of, you know, some division right from the get-go on this covenant. You know, not everybody right. was on board.
Right, and the seeds of Eliashib's disobedience were sown, you know, 10 or 15 years ago, mm-hmm, when he was in league with Tobiah. Right. And Tobiah, well, as we'll talk about later on, he had pretty good sway around Jerusalem for a lot of folks. Okay, that's great. Great point. And it's just another application is make sure you are very careful who you become associated with, because you tend to become like them if you're not very careful with that. So that's a great comment. Thank you. So we get to Jerusalem, and the wall is built, the temple is built, all these things. So what do they do as a celebration? Who do they go to look for to kind of kick off this celebration and this praise for God? They go to find the Levites to lead the this celebration. Okay? And what does the celebration entail? How do they do it? What are the logistics of it?
Half go one way, half go the other way.
Okay. So take out your map of the walls real quick if you have that handy. So there's one group that goes up and goes to the left, one group that goes up and goes to the right. So what's the purpose of that? What does that do to their enemies when they see the people of Jerusalem up on top of the walls, marching around, playing instruments, giving praise, those sort of things? What does that tell their enemies?
Well, it does tell them that if a fox jumps on it, it's not going to fall in.
Exactly. Exactly. So that the rumor about the fox stuff doesn't work out. What else does it tell them?
They're back.
Right. Mm-hmm. And they're not afraid anymore. They're not afraid of their enemies.
So I guess my question is, I guess these walls were, I'm thinking this, but they were...
No, because you remember they had to go to Tyre to get the big beams and the big rocks and so forth. So they were large enough so that, you know, a column of people could walk around them. Okay. So, yeah, you're right. And, you know, you see some of the ancient cities, you think, well, the wall is like this, but some of the ancient cities were big enough that they could have chariot races on the wall.
Well, it was like a great wall of China. Okay.
Yeah. So, they were built with great stones and great timbers, and that's why the enemies were upset about it. Because, you know, I guess a fox could knock this thing down. So they have two great choirs that go up there. What sort of things go on with the choir, and what do they do? And is it vocal music? Is it instrumental and vocal? What kind of music do they do?
Well, they had instruments. Yeah.
Okay, they had instruments. Okay. All right. So what else do we see going on with that? Where do they end up after they're up on top of the walls?
Verge of the temple.
Okay, so they come to the verge of the temple, and when they get there, what do?
They take their stand.
Yeah, they take their stand. They proudly worship God in song and with the symbols and so forth. And what they had was, and we still have those to some degree today. They had antiphonal singing. One group would sing, another group would answer. Then they would answer back and so forth. So, plus they also had the instruments that were involved in the worship at that point in time as well. So it's a great celebration. And what does it say about the celebration in terms of the foreigners around them?
Well, verse 43 talks about the great joy and how it was shared by so many and could be heard from afar, from the city of Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
So this celebration was evident to those some distance away.
That's right. So it was a great celebration. It was very demonstrative. It was very loud. It was very noticeable. So what's the application for us? What do we declare? How do we declare it?
Every Sunday.
We declare that we believe that our Lord and Savior rose from the grave. And we believe that he lived a sinner's life. And we believe he's the Son of God. And we believe that he has asked us to remember that each week in this supper. So, you know, some people say, well, you know, if you take the Lord's Supper all the time, it becomes commonplace. Well, no. Only if you let it become commonplace. So, we are announcing to the world every first day of the week that we believe in Jesus, that he's our Lord, that he came from that grave alive, never to die again. And that gives us the opportunity to have our sins forgiven. So just like they were declaring to their enemies, our God has done this. Our God has brought us back our God, as Zechariah said, this is not of our work, of our work or our doing, but it's God's Spirit. So they were announcing to the world around them that our God has brought us back. Now, when Tobiah and Sanballat were trying to discourage them, what were some of the things they were asking? They're kind of sarcastic questions. Can they offer sacrifices?
Yeah.
Yes. Can they build it in a day? No. But they can build it in a reasonable time. And can they revive these stones from a dusty rubble? Yes, yes, and yes. And so they were answering the enemies of God by saying, you profaned our God and blasphemed our God by saying this could never happen. But it has. And now we have reestablished things. So, we now have this great celebration, this high point, this great things that are going on. But we get to verse 6 of chapter 13. And how does the scene shift as we get down to verse 6? Nehemiah goes back to the king in Persia, which he said he would do. And the king asked him a couple of questions when he asked about going to Jerusalem. What did he ask him?
How long will
he be gone? How long will he be gone? When will he come back? And Nehemiah gave him a definite answer. So he had to go back to the king. And I guess he told the king it would be, 12 years or whatever it was. So he goes back to the king in Persia, and what happens? There are several things that go on. Well, before we get there, yeah, that's right. So several things happen, but the seeds of those things happening have been in place for a long time. So it wasn't, it didn't just happen overnight. The seeds of those things have been around for quite a while, even back in Ezra's time in Jerusalem, which predated Nehemiah's. So the leader had gone back to Persia. What does that tell us about those who followed him?
Stayed in Jerusalem?
No, the ones who were left in Jerusalem.
Yeah.
We said they didn't learn?
Yeah.
Okay. What else?
They weren't trustworthy.
They weren't trustworthy? Okay. And?
They weren't serious about the following.
They weren't serious about it. And where did the departure come from? Leaders. Where does the fish rot from? The head. So we see the high priest being one of the people that is involved in this apostasy, in this blasphemous behavior. So what are some of the things that, what does Nehemiah kind of rehearse here? What's the first thing he sees?
Well, he sees the department.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. So he sees that Tobiah has been given this little corner broom closet in the temple, right? No. Mm-hmm. He's been given a large, spacious room in the temple. And who gave him that room in the temple? Eliashib. The high priest.
Yes, but also his kinsman.
Right. So not only was Eliashib bound to him by an oath, Eliashib also had a son who was married to daughter. It was a daughter or son. Anyway, he had one of his children that was married to into his family. So what do we see about Eliashib? What can we learn from that? What's the application to us?
Well, when you repurposed verse 5 is the evidence that they weren't providing for the house of God, mm-hmm. right? So he kind of repurposed that chamber or that area.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's sort of the, you can't serve two masters mm-hmm. type of situation where he's got this existing relationship with Tobiah, and then he also is trying to work with Nehemiah.
Mm-hmm.
And then as soon as Nehemiah is gone, he switches back to the old master.
That's right. That's right. And what does that tell us about what application we make to our lives about who we follow? If your righteousness was based on Eliashib, where were you going?
Going
the opposite direction from God.
The wrong way.
The wrong way. So we need to be very careful whom we follow. And we need to be very careful that we examine those that we follow on a constant basis and make sure that, I'm sure on certain days, Eliashib looked like a regular high priest, you know, probably wore the garb and did the sacrifices, but the true colors came out when Nehemiah left. And I think, you know, what does 2 Timothy 2 say about, you know, leaders training leaders? Commit these words to faithful men who can teach others also. So Nehemiah may not have done as much as he should have in training the leaders who he left behind. So sometimes that can happen. I don't know. It could have been that Eliashib was just always had this tendency, as you said, and was kind of trying to live on both sides of the fence.
Well, I guess where I was going with this verse 5 is the application here is, you know, one disobedience many times will then lead to another disobedience and on and on and on. Mm-hmm. So the disobedience initially was they weren't providing. Well, now, hey, got this room available. Why don't you just set up in there?
Right.
And it just goes on from there.
That's right. Sin leads to sin.
Yeah.
Doing things out of convenience. Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, you know, nobody's here. There's some of the priests and Levites have left. So, you know, it's convenient. Why don't you just, you know, stay here? And Tobiah probably said, well, that's great. I can, you know, just come over, come down the hall and collect my, you know, my bribe money from you and so forth. And one of the things that my parents all, you know, tried to drill into my thick head my entire life was there's no such thing as one individual sin. And no individual sin not affecting anybody else. Sin leads to sin. Like, you know, my dad always said, don't ever lie, son, because you have to remember what you said.
Yeah.
And there's no such thing as telling one lie. Because if you tell one lie, you got to tell another one to cover up that, and you know, it just keeps building. So as you said, sin leads to sin, and he obviously had a divided allegiance. So Nehemiah is gone, so we have the room for Tobiah being taken care of. What else do we see?
Great, I wonder.
Yeah.
I'm not sure which came first. So in Lynn's rendering here, they stopped making the offerings, and so this room became available. So we give Tobiah. I would be surprised the other way around. It's like, okay, Tobiah, you want a place in our temple? Let's clear out all this grain. We don't need this anymore. You can stay here. And that backup leads to, well, we can't make the offerings anymore. There's no place to keep them. And that leads others into sin in that direction.
Yeah, could be. It could be.
Which came first.
Yeah, and the one thing that, one commentary that Nehemiah makes on is, I wasn't there when these things were going on.
Exactly.
Now, the seeds of those things had happened long before. So he comes back and he sees Tobiah. So obviously, he takes Tobiah's stuff and throws it out and has the room cleansed and so forth. That's one of the first things. Did you have, I saw another hand or comment upon it.
Sort of reminiscent of Jesus going through the temple and cleansing the temple.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Well, I was thinking about Moses going up on the mountain and golden calf.
Yeah. I mean, well, this Moses is gone. We don't know where he's gone, so we've got to create our God that took us out of Egypt, you know. So that's very. But let's not be too judgmental of them, because we have a greater prize and we have a greater gift. And sometimes we are double-minded as well. So we need to learn from their example and not follow it. So he takes Tobiah's stuff and throws it around the temple. Now, was that a pretty big risk for him to take? Was Tobiah pretty well connected?
Mm-hmm.
Did he have a lot of folks under oath to him?
Yeah.
He was one of those guys that, you know, he had kind of owned the company store. And so Nehemiah took a professional and personal risk by tossing him out, but he knew it was the right thing to do. And he knew it was the right thing to get rid of him, because that was a violation of a very clear prohibition in Moses' law. You should not have Ammonites, you should have Moabites, and so forth. Now, so what does he see next? What's the next issue?
Working on the Sabbath.
Okay. Not before we get there, though. Right. In chapter 10, or chapter, verse 10. So what is the sinful thing going on there? Did Moses' law say you need to provide for the Levites?
Yes.
Absolutely.
They weren't doing it.
Right. And as you guys have mentioned, if you don't take care of the Levites, what do the Levites have to go do?
They have to work.
They have to go to a farm, go to a field. And they had to go back because they were not being taken care of by the people. And so we see, what does Nehemiah say in verse 11?
Why is the house again forsaken?
Yeah, you guys have done all this work to get back to Jerusalem. You've done all this work to rebuild the temple. You've done all this work to build these walls, and now you've forsaken the temple. And why is that so important? Go ahead, Jason.
So I guess questions, because I guess people get confused on what the Levites had and what they didn't have when they came to the cities versus territories. If they were going back to their fields, what fields did the Levites have?
That's a good question. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Or they may have just had to sign on with somebody who had a field. Yeah. I don't know. But you're right. They were given cities here and there. But after the area was destroyed, I'm not sure if they still have those cities or just plots of land or whatever. But they were supposed to be taken care of by the people, that they were not doing it. So
I suspect they were out in the villages with everybody else, right?
Right.
Chapter 11 talks about
having returned to the villages.
The draft to get people to come back into the city after the walls were built, so most of the people are now surrounding areas.
Right, absolutely. Yeah. So they're not taking care of the temple. So what does that cause? What are some of the collateral effects that you already mentioned to some degree? Has a direct impact on whom?
Well, Levites.
The Levites and the singers and the gatekeepers and the people that cleaned, people that restored the temple, all those folks.
Tell God, it says, why is the house of God forsaken?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So they had done all these things to restore it, and now they're forsaking it and walking away from it. So what's the application for us? What lesson do we need to take from that?
Yeah.
We need to contribute to the work of the Lord.
Some of us, yeah.
Yeah. We need to contribute to the work of the Lord as we've been told to do. Because there are different things that the work of the Lord, the treasury, particularly for the congregation, has to do. Support men, needy saints, those kind of things. And we need to do that. And we need to be consistent with that. And we need to be planning ahead for those sort of things and not going, what do I have left in my pocket when I walk in the building? That's not purposing in your heart. So we need to do that and make sure that we're supporting the work of the Lord and those who are doing the work of the Lord. So I think that's very important. What does that show about the people's attitude toward the Levites, though?
They didn't respect them. Mm-hmm.
Didn't respect them, didn't value what they did, and not only that, they didn't value the God that commanded them to take care of them. So there's a lot of dynamics going on there that are unhealthy. So we have violation of foreigners in the temple. We have violation of supporting the Levites in the temple. What do we see next? Okay, David, go ahead.
I was just going to say, it comes down to what they have authority for. And in the same way today, we have certain authority to do things in worship.
Sure.
So if we're doing things that we don't have authority for, this is what's going to happen. It's going to turn into this. Because all these things that Nehemiah is restoring, he's bringing back to the old law and saying, this is why we had to do it and we had authority to do it.
Uh-huh.
And then once the man-made wisdom comes in, then that's when things go wrong. And that happens all the time in worship. But the application for us is to make sure our worship and churches, they have authority to do what we do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And how does it usually work out when man tries to help out God?
It doesn't.
You ever been to the Middle East?
Mm-hmm.
You know where that came from? Trying to help out God. Ishmael and Isaac. It's still going on. And probably as long as the world stands, it will continue to go on. Because they tried to help out God. and to do things a different way than God had recommended or had commanded. That's very important. So, what do we see him doing on the Sabbath?
Everything.
Okay.
Pressing wine, merchandising.
They're working themselves, pressing the wine. What else?
Buying and selling.
Loading on donkeys.
Loading stuff on donkeys. And also, who were they buying from?
Foreigners.
The Tyrenians. Now, why? What does the Sabbath mean to God's people?
Well, it's supposed to remind us of how we came out of
Egypt. Go ahead, Laura. And then Ken.
It was supposed to be set apart and to be holy.
Okay, absolutely. It's supposed to be set apart and holy, and to make them a peculiar people than everybody else. Yes.
Just to remind them that they were brought out of Egypt by the hand of God.
Mm-hmm. And also, it goes back to what as its origin?
Back to reading.
The creation. So, go ahead. Yeah.
To rest at that time, to trust that the Lord is going to fulfill your needs.
Mm-hmm. That's right. So we have, if you look at the Old Testament, the Ten Commandments, you have the first few commandments that talk about a relationship to God, the last several talk about a relationship to man, and the Sabbath is the bridge between those two. So the Sabbath is important because it harkens back to God's creative ability in making the world. It also talks about the rest that they have now that he has taken them from their bondage of Egypt. And also, as you mentioned, it calls on their faith. Because I remember when I was going to a church when I was a kid in Tampa, there was a guy who had a hardware store. And he would never, ever come to church on Wednesday night because he had to keep his hardware store open for those couple extra hours. And he just had to keep his hardware store open for those couple extra hours. And so after about 10 or 15 years, he said, well, I'm just going to close up 6:30, see what happens. Next Wednesday, he said, I'm going to close up at 6:30. What happened to his business?
It grew.
Because there are people in the town who said, oh, he must be going to church tonight. He must be an honest man. I can do business with him. So, He was making the trade-off in his mind. Well, I can't go be with the saints because I need to keep my business open. And now they're making the trade-off saying, well, we have to do business on the Sabbath because what if it's not available tomorrow? You know, what if they catch all these fish on Friday and we can't get them until Sunday? Well, they're going to rot. So, number one, it goes back to their reliance on God, their belief in God as the creator and sustainer, and then also, it tells the people around them what about their view of the law that they signed on to.
It doesn't mean much.
Because we said we're not going to do any of this. But now they're doing it. So what's the application for us in that?
It's very simple. If we ignore God's law, it doesn't mean a whole lot to us.
Yeah. And what does it say about our faith if when something happens in the world, we fall apart like everybody else does? Mm-hmm. Remember when we had that service after 9/11? Mm-hmm. And we had invited people from the community to come in? What were some of the comments they had? What's wrong with you people? Don't you know what's going on? Don't you know what just happened? Yeah, we know. Some evil people killed several thousand other people. And that was wrong. And that was bad. But God's still in control. God knows what's going on. And so they were just, well, don't you understand? It's like, yeah, we understand. But there's more at play than what you can see with your eyes. You have to see with your heart of faith. And I think that's very important to show that lesson to the world. So we see that. And then after that, everything was good, right? No. So Nehemiah reacted fairly even-handedly in these other ones. So what does he do with issue number 3? What is the issue? Mixed marriages among Ammonites, Moabites,
and Ashdod.
And folks from Ashdod, which is the Philistines. Yes?
I can go back to just kind of finishing up about the Sabbath, because this is something that I've been able to apply to me as just with our household. Mm-hmm. In verses 19 through 22. And he says, he shuts the doors. And so, and and within your family, when you set firm barriers, mm-hmm. people are going to test them.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to be ready to show resistance to it. And then once that barrier is set, it gets tested. And just like here, out of my experience, is once people understand the barriers mm-hmm. are there and they're real, they kind of back off. You know?
Yeah.
And that can be like coaches,
mm-hmm.
and the barriers for and band directors,
mm-hmm.
just things with your kids, and just trying to have your kids see what those barriers are. And they get tested.
Yeah, later. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's great. And one of the things that my parents always tried to emphasize to me as I got old enough to understand was that, you know, children need a couple things. They need love, and they need boundaries. And they need both of those things not to move. They need consistency. And if you can do that, they may not like the boundary, but they know where it is. And if you show love, then they know that you're doing it out of a spirit of love, and eventually they'll grow up enough to figure that part out. So how does he react with this Ammonite Moabite stuff?
Oh, just be that.
So what does he do?
Contended with them, and he cursed them, and he struck them, and he pulled out their hair.
Pulled out some of the hair, pulled out some of their beard. Now, why the difference? Why the reaction to one sin one way and another sin a different way?
Isn't this when he talks about Solomon?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it happens whenever it led Solomon away.
The wisest man in the world mm-hmm. was led away. And also, when you look in the book of Jude, what does Jude say about getting someone out of sin? Show mercy on some, mm-hmm. and others do what? Snatch them out of the fire. So if my son and I were downtown in Atlanta, and he was about to pick up some food off of the sidewalk and eat it, I'd say, son, don't do that. That's not good. It'll make you sick. But if he was walking out in front of a MARTA bus, I would grab him and pull him back onto the sidewalk. And I think what Nehemiah is doing is he sees how destructive this is. And he sees, you guys have, your history is littered with doing this the wrong way. And now you finally have the opportunity to get away from that. And now you're going back. So, I mean, why he did that way, I don't know. I don't know if that was just his strong reaction to what had happened before or what it was, and I don't know if he was, I don't see that he was ever chastised for it by God, but he may have been. So we see that there, you know.
He's gone through this with Ezra.
Yeah.
And it's supposed to be taken care of.
Right.
Then, so maybe that has been do
that. Yeah. And it could have been that we talked about this, we've dealt with this, and now I go away and I see it happening again. Also, something very interesting he says about the children. What does he say about the children?
Couldn't speak
the
people of Judah.
Right, they spoke the language of Ashdod and not the language of Judah. So what's the application for us with our children and young folks?
Well, I was going to say, I was thinking about my old neighbors that were Syria,
mm-hmm.
but they were Christian as opposed to being Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the Muslims made their kids go to Muslim school.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying that right.
School or Muslim, yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So they can learn to read the Quran.
Right.
Whereas, you know, because if they didn't read or understand the Quran, you know, they wouldn't retain it.
So what's the application for us? How much time do we spend teaching our children the language of Judah
mm-hmm.
as opposed to the language of Ashdod?
Right.
The language of the world. The philosophies of the world. Now, there's some good ideas out there. There's some smart people out there. But our focus has to be on making sure that we and our children understand the language of Judah. Now being the language of Jesus. Yes, David, go ahead.
One thing that struck me, Grady, comparing this versus what we saw with Ezra, similar situation with the intermarriage. And Ezra, as I remember, just poured out his heart to the Lord and contrition and
mm-hmm.
made a big show. I mean, it became a big show. And saw how horrible things were through his reaction. And the hearts of the people seemed to realize, okay, we've messed up here, and they wanted to make things right. And that seemed to be sufficient for them.
says here, Nehemiah contended with them, cursed them, struck some of them, pulled out their hair. We don't know exactly what the reaction is, but I get the impression they were not like struck by Nehemiah's, you know, devastation of what had happened and realized, oh, we need to repent. They seem to be more, they have their heels dug in.
They're rebellious.
Yes, it's a very different sort of response, and so I think that necessitated a different sort of reaction to Nehemiah's situation.
And all of you as parents understand disobedience versus rebellion. And my dad made it very clear to me early that neither one would be tolerated, but rebellion would receive much more swift and direct and painful retribution. So I think, you know, there's something to what you said about this being just high-handed sin to God saying, we don't care. We've been talked, they've told us about this, we have known about this, but we're going to do what we want to do. So I think that that may be part of it as well. So just preview of coming attractions. We will be on lesson number 15, Lord willing, on Sunday, which is a review lesson. However, I have promised you that you have 20 minutes at the end of class to tell me everything you've learned about these two books. Only two questions. What can we learn from Ezra and Nehemiah's leadership style? And what are the applications of what we learned from them to today? So it'll be class participation for the last 20 minutes, or, you know, a nice nap if not. So anyway, and we'll go through the review questions and so forth, and for the first 20 or 25 minutes, and we'll save that last part for the applications and so forth, because I think that's the most important thing. You know, what king ruled from what year to what year? That's important. You know, what territory was? That's important. The names and dates, that's important. But the most important thing is, as the Apostle Paul told us, these things were written for our learning, that we might apply those lessons to our lives and learn from them and not make the same mistakes, hopefully. One other thing I want to, you know, what do we see about Nehemiah's leadership style in the way he dealt with the intermarriage? Was there a risk in doing that?
Yeah.
That way?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. He could have upset some of Tobiah's buddies and said, hey, listen, you know, we looked around Jerusalem, we couldn't find anybody. Ammonite, Moabite, you know, folks, Ashdod folks were available, those kind of things. But he took a great risk doing that. And also he took a very forceful stand. And what oftentimes when someone does that, what happens when someone does that?
Look at the children.
Wow.
This is too harsh.
Yeah. You see what he just did? I can't believe he would react like that. Well, righteous indignation. And not only that, but also him being a leader, he sees where that's going. And takes them back. You remember the smartest guy who ever lived?
Yeah.
Did he survive doing that?
No.
No. And that's one of the seeds that brought them to where they are now. Where they were in captivity. Is being divided in their loyalty, because God never said, I'm the greatest God. He said, I am the only God. There is no other. And you have to be completely loyal to me and not bring these other gods in. And what they have done is just brought all the other gods in, along with Jehovah, and said, well, he's one among the gods. And therefore, that was part of their destruction. And we see that oftentimes, you know, people that don't have the history don't understand the roots of things and where they go. And they haven't seen it before. But Nehemiah takes them back and says, remember what happened? Remember where it led? Remember where you were for the last 70 years? So Nehemiah uses that ability to communicate and that ability to make them understand how serious this is. Because this was God's plan to bring them back. And that could have wrecked the entire thing. So, great discussion. I appreciate all your great comments tonight. Very, very helpful. And we'll be in lesson 15, Lord willing, on Sunday morning. And you guys will have some great commentary for the last 20 minutes of class.
What were the two questions again?
What we learned from the leadership style of Ezra and Nehemiah. And what applications can we learn from these two books? Applications to our lives. Good comments, folks.
So great.